Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Well, I dare you to find a better show than the Patrick Madrid Show, Andy.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, here we are, hour three. Let's do it. 888-914-9149. I see all of you who are waiting on the lines. Thank you for your patience. I'm coming to you shortly here. If you want to call in, there is a line or two. So there are a line or two. Is a line or two. You can get one of them if you call now, 888-914-9149. So we're going to go back to you, Harold, in Queen Creek, Arizona. You had asked me about spiritual warfare, right? And if I had ever experienced anything like that. And I think you said, like, when I was going to give a talk, a public talk. Is that what you're referring to? Okay. Well, the answer is yes. The answer is yes, not too often, but I do remember one vividly that really got my attention. This was in Los Angeles at a parish in the early 90s. I was giving a talk there in Spanish. Not that that matters one way or the other, but as I was walking, this is before, let me think, it was at night, and it was before the talk began, and I was walking out to my car in the parking lot to get my Bible. And the best way I can explain this is as I was walking, just, you know, nonchalantly thinking about what I would be speaking about that evening, all of a sudden there was this, what I felt to be like this massive intrusive attack on my imagination. And I had a very clear sense that this was a diabolical effort. And it was, I won't explain what it was that I saw, but I saw all of a sudden, as if it were like right in front of me, as if it were really there right in front of me, an image that was assaulting my chastity and purity. And it was unlike anything I had ever experienced before. It wasn't like an idea in my mind, or it wasn't like how your imagination conjures up pictures. It was more real than that. I had never experienced anything like this before. And it was right there in front of me, and it was extremely vivid, extremely powerful. And I also, as it happened to me, I had this really deep sense of certitude that this is from the devil here and now. This is being done to me here and now. So I just pushed past it. I was startled by it. I was momentarily disconcerted by it. But then I don't remember exactly, but I think I started praying. I think I just prayed in Our Father and prayed Hail Mary and just went and got my Bible. And I came back and I pushed it out of my mind. But I've never forgotten it because it was so unusual. So maybe that's, I don't know if that's what you're talking about, but that one time that I'm aware of anyway is something that I still remember to this day. And I think old Hairy Legs was trying to, you know, he was trying to get in there if he possibly could. So thanks be to God and the intercession of the Blessed Virgin Mary didn't work. But if that's what you're asking about, yeah, I have had that one experience.
Yeah, so that's what is important, to pray all the time, and people asking people to pray. I know you're not doing exorcisms, but you know, but when you talk, some people change their lives sometimes. And so the devil knows that that happens, so he doesn't want it. So he prevents, you know, try to prevent.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So I was just wondering if you ever had those type of moments and things like that.
Thankfully, not many, if many at all. And really the only one I can remember with any clarity is that one incident. Other than that, if there have been other things like that. Now, I know that the devil is always lurking around and trying to nibble around the edges and get in there if he can. And so I'm aware that it's probably an ongoing thing for you and for me and for all of us. But greater is he who is in us than he who is in the world. So we should have, we should be cognizant of his presence and fight against it and be prayerful and focus on Jesus more than anything else. The worst thing that could happen is if somebody becomes morose and frightened and all of those things that can easily happen if you allow it to. So we have to keep our eyes fixed on Jesus and stay in the state of grace. That's one big thing right there. Thanks, Harold. I appreciate it. Let's go to Norma in California. Hi, Norma.
Hi, good morning. I have a quick question.
Uh-huh.
I happened to be in the car with my grandson yesterday, and he started talking about God, and that God was not good, and he was using words like mean because he, I guess he was talking about the times of Moses when all these people were doing...
Norma, do you have a television on in the background? Because it's very distracting. I hear something else happening in the background there.
Let me turn off the radio.
That would be good. Yeah, while Norma's doing that, a little public service announcement. If you want to be on the air, you have to have the radio off or anything else like that because it becomes very distracting and difficult to hear.
No, I turn it off.
Thank you.
Sorry about that.
Okay. So your grandson thinks that God is mean because why?
Because all these people, and he had names, I don't remember all of them, or what. But he said they all tried to do all the good things for him, and he let them die, or he killed them. And why will God be good?
Okay.
So,
well, it is
it my mind. You ask you, or if you have a book, or where can I? How can I?
It is true that. In the Bible, especially in the Old Testament, you see lots of people who died or were killed, lots of people who disobeyed God and were punished. And God worked with his people in those days in a much more strict and harsh way than he does with us now. And there's some theories as to why that is the case. One theory is that when a child is little, children require a certain kind of discipline that would not be appropriate for a teenager or even, say, an older young adult, for example. And so the way in which God is a father to his children changes as those children mature. Now, that's one theory, and there's a lot to it, but that's a possibility. One thing for sure, though, is that God does not do things out of malice. God does not do things because he's mean or any of those things. That's looking at it from a human perspective. God does everything that he does do out of love. Sometimes the love is tough because the son or daughter needs correction. And sometimes the corrections are very stern. It says in the Epistle to the Hebrews that God chastises the son whom he loves. And there's a mystery there. If you really love the son, why are you harsh with him? Well, part of the answer is that you're harsh with him to some extent because you love him and because you care so much that you want your son or your daughter to grow up well and to grow up mature and balanced, etc. And if you are indulgent with a child and let the child run wild and never face any consequences, and if you're never stern or even harsh as needed with a child, you're going to have a child who's going to grow up to be a wretched adult who will be egotistical and selfish and all of the above. So that's part of this mystery. Why do we see God allowing suffering? Why did he allow the Israelites, his chosen people, to be carried away in captivity? Well, it's interesting. He actually tells them why he's permitting this to happen, and that is the result very often of their infidelity, seeking after false gods, trying to be like the Gentiles, wanting to do the things that God said, you're not supposed to do these things. And so this wayward group of people who were very often not faithful to the Lord and his covenant with them, they were not living up to their status very often as the chosen people. So God permitted punishments to befall them to number one, to punish them for their infidelity, but also to remind them that they don't have to deal with those punishments if they would just simply follow his plan for their happiness and salvation. So that's part of it. I would recommend, Norma, if you're really wanting to dig deeper into it, two things. One is get a book called Is God a Moral Monster? And that's by Paul Copan, C-O-P-P-A-N. And that's the whole book, is looking at these Old Testament examples of why did God allow this to happen? Why did God tell this group of people, you're going to be punished, and why did these people die, etc.? So he goes into that, and there's a lot there, but I think that book will be clarifying for you if you're interested. Now, a second book, if you're interested, deals more with the problem of evil And that is a book I recommend often by Dr. Peter Kraft. It's called Making Sense Out of Suffering. And he, in that book, takes up this question, well, if God is really all good and he's all powerful, then how do you explain the presence of evil? Because that would suggest that either God is not really all loving because he's allowing this evil to happen, or he's not all powerful because he can't stop it from happening. And some people make the mistake of reasoning their way toward the claim that God doesn't exist because evil exists. So in that book, Making Sense Out of Suffering, what Kraft does is he analyzes this and he shows how to understand bad things happening to good people or bad things happening in general, and how to see that this is not inconsistent with an all-powerful and all-loving God, and that he permits these things, or he punishes at times for just reason. I'll have to leave it at that, but I hope that's helpful to you, Norma. Let's go now to Maria in Madison, Wisconsin. Good morning, Maria.
Yeah, good morning, Patrick. So I wanted to ask you, what would you say to a 9-year-old in the following situation? She goes to Catholic school, and I have a niece that she doesn't go. She goes to public school. So we were driving by, and in one of these places, she points and says, "Oh, they have the pride flag."
Mm-hmm.
And I was surprised because we never talk about it.
Right.
And I said, "What?" And she said, "Yeah, the pride flag." And I said, "Who told you that is that? That's the name."
Yep.
And then she says, "My niece told mm-hmm. her." And I say, "Oh, yeah. The flag that means that they mm-hmm. welcome everyone."
Is that flag in her school?
No. We were driving by.
I see. Okay. I thought you were about to tell me that the school was, you know, imposing such things on the children. So she saw the flag, and she said, "Well, my cousin or whoever the other girl was said that this is a flag that means everybody is welcome."
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so what would you say?
Yeah, I guess what I would say is it's too bad that I have to explain this to you at the age that you are right now, but this is the world we live in. That flag, the people who fly it, that may be what they think it means, but what it really means is something more than just all people are welcome. And what it really means is that there are some really, really bad sins that some people commit. And we don't have to talk about that right now because you're too young to know about those kinds of sins. Eventually, I'll tell you about that more. And I'm going to tell you more about what the good way to live in this area is, but you're not old enough for that yet. In the meantime, though, just know this, that there are some people who they commit some really bad sins, and they rather than being sorry for committing these sins, because they know in their conscience that this is not right, but rather than be sorry for their sins, they have become defiant. I don't know if she would know what the word defiant is, stubborn, defiant. And they are insisting that what they're doing is not only not sinful, but it's something that people should celebrate. And God says, no, this is not something you should be doing. Therefore, this flag is their way of saying that we're not doing anything wrong, and we're proud of it. We're proud of doing what we do, and you can't tell us that what we're doing is wrong. And that will get you back to this notion that the flag represents that everyone is welcomed. And you could point out to her, that's not really the case, because somebody like Jesus, or somebody, you know, a Catholic, a follower of Jesus, who says that activity that you're doing is wrong, you shouldn't do it, well, you're not welcome. They will not welcome you if you hold the view that God does, that you shouldn't be doing these things. If you say that's wrong, then they don't accept you. So there are people that they don't welcome and that they really, really don't like. And that's why you have to understand that's not what this flag really means. It's a celebration of sin. And when you get old enough, we'll talk more about it. But for the time being, just know that. That's probably how I would approach it.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, it's a shame that you have to have a conversation like that with a 9-year-old, but this is the world we live in. So thank you. Let's go now to Mary in Wisconsin. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I always enjoy your program, so thank you.
Thank you.
I just was looking for your opinion. I have a daughter-in-law that is was brought up in the Baptist and doesn't believe in baptism for our 5 grandchildren. Mm-hmm. Anyways, I was thinking of giving her your book, and I just wanted your opinion on that.
Well, what do you think my opinion is going to be? I'm joking. I think it'd be wonderful if you gave her, you're talking about the new book, the free book, right? Inquisition?
Yeah.
I think it'd be great. First of all, because there's a lot of biblical stuff in there. And if she's an evangelical Christian, she's going to like that because she's geared toward the Bible. So that's a good thing. Second thing is it may offer her some food for thought. It will offer her food for thought on the Catholic faith that seems that she has walked away from, if that's what happened. So that'll be good.
No, she's never been brought. Yeah, she's never been Catholic. She was just brought up in Baptist.
I see.
In the Baptist.
Okay.
Background.
So this book will be a window for her into the Catholic Church, and it'll be fun.
Yeah.
It's going to be interesting for her. She'll learn some things. She'll find out, oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting. And maybe it will spark her interest in knowing more. And, of course, there are other books that you can give her as a result of that. But this would be a fun, easy, low impact, non-confrontational way to put something in her hands that she could enjoy as an evangelical Protestant that could get things rolling. You know what I mean?
Okay. Yeah.
Here's how you get the book. If you have your pen handy, let me tell you. So go to relevantradio.com/quiz, relevantradio.com/quiz. And just now you're going to order a book for yourself. So if you haven't already done that, order your book. And then you can text her a link to the page, relevantradio.com/quiz, and just say, hey, this book is free. I think you'll enjoy it. Just pop your name in there and she'll get the book in due time. It won't take very long. So give it a try.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Great. You're welcome. One final thing, one parting gift, Mary. Before you go, I would also text her to her phone, text her the link to the Relevant Radio app. And here's how you can easily do that. Go to relevantradio.com. Under Listen, you scroll down in that drop-down menu. At the very, somewhere near the bottom, it says Get the App. Click on that, and that'll give you the website where the app information is located. She'll see a picture of it, information, etc. Grab the link in the address bar and text that link to her and just say, here is a very interesting radio network. They're national. They're on 200 stations. And there's this guy on in the morning, Patrick Madrid Show. And I'll bet you would find this very interesting because he talks about the Bible and he talks about God topics and he talks about things that you're interested in. And here's the link. All you have to do is put the app on your phone and you can listen anytime you want. And don't be surprised if she downloads the app. It's free. And if she starts listening, who knows? Maybe she'll be coming into the Catholic Church in due time. You never know. And God works this way very often here at Relevant Radio. So give that a try, Mary. And do order your free book, your free copy of Inquisition. Coming right up, more of the Patrick Madrid Show and your phone calls right after this. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Let me ask you, can the Catholic Church have a future if we Catholics don't understand our past? Experience history the way it should be taught in a free online class from Christendom College. Just go to principlesclasses.com.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
I have a note here from Jerry, who writes in from Philadelphia. Thanks for writing to me, Jerry. I think it's he. He says, in a past show, Patrick, you mentioned an herbal supplement that you take when you travel to help you sleep. I could use this also. Please tell me what the herb is, what the dosage is, and who makes it. Thanks. Great show. Keep up the good work. Will you be around Philadelphia anytime soon? Well, on that score, probably not. I don't think I have anything planned for Philadelphia. But I'm there with you in spirit, if nothing else. So what I take, and by the way, I'm not prescribing anything. I'm not giving medical advice or anything like that because I'm not a doctor. But if you're wondering what it is that I have found helpful in the rare occasions where I might need a little help getting drowsy and falling asleep, it's valerian root. Valerian, V-A-L-E-R-I-A-N. And the way it works is, first of all, there's no active ingredient. There's nothing that you can get addicted to. There's no pharmaceuticals of any kind. It's just an herb. And that's what it's called, a valerian root. Comes in a capsule form. And the one that I get, excuse me, the brand that I get anyway is American Standard Supplements. That doesn't matter really. You could find it in your local grocery store. It's prevalent. And the one I take is 1,800 milligrams. So it's in capsule. If you want to feel, I don't know, maybe a little drowsy and ready to fall asleep, I would say what I do is I take a couple of these, two, three, you know, at the most. I mean, you could take four, five, six. It's not going to hurt you. It's not like there's any negative side effect. But I typically would take two or three of these about a half an hour before I'd like to fall asleep. And what it does is it promotes drowsiness, kind of like chamomile tea, I think. Certain other herbs have these properties of promoting sleep and helping your body to start unwinding. That's what this does. There's no drug in it of any kind. So that's it. If you find help with that, great. A lot of people that I've recommended to have. Let's go to Amerna. I hope I'm saying your name correctly, in Tampa, Florida. Amerna, welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Madrid. I wanted to ask you about workplace conflict with religion.
Okay.
I presently work as a dining room server at a dining room at a living assisting facility.
Okay.
That I later found is connected to a Jewish educational center for protecting Jewry traditions.
Okay.
And they're with the rabbi and everything. recently the boss told me that I can't take Sundays off. So I don't know. I don't know if there's a conflict there with perhaps Catholic religion. I don't know.
There could be. Did he give you a reason why he wouldn't give you Sundays off?
He said that he really needed me to help him serve the food and that he didn't have any other servers.
Okay, that's not unreasonable, but that means that if you work that job, that you would not be able to fulfill your Sunday obligation. And the church says that with, you know, under certain circumstances, if you're ill or you're taking care of a sick child or you're traveling and it's just impossible for you to get to Mass, or you work a job where it's impossible for you to get to Mass, then that it's not a sin if you can't fulfill your Sunday obligation. I think, though, that in a situation like this, if you say to him, well, I totally understand it, but I'm a Catholic and I have to go to Mass on Sunday, could I at least start my shift maybe at noon or at 9, and perhaps you can get to Mass early on Sunday, fulfill your Sunday obligation, and then get to work in time to do what they need you to do. He might be flexible in that way. So if you like your job and you'd like to continue working there, that would be one solution that comes to my mind. See if you can arrange it so that you can get to Mass. Another possibility would be if there's a Catholic church in the vicinity, then arrange with him that on your lunch hour, maybe they have a noon Mass, for example, at that parish, and you're going to take your lunch hour from, you know, 11:45 to 12:45, and then you could go to Mass. And there are ways that you can make this work. Now, if he says, nope, sorry, I need you here from 7 in the morning until 5 in the afternoon, and there is no other available Mass, then you have to make a decision. Do I really want to work here so much that I'm willing to not go to Mass on Sunday? And for me personally, I would say no. It's not like you're a physician delivering babies on Sunday, because babies are going to come when they come. And sometimes you have to work on Sunday. Or if you're a police officer or an airline pilot, certain things that are necessary, you have to do them on Sunday. And of course, that would be different. But in your case, if you have an option, and it might mean saying, well, I wish I could work here because I really like it, but since I have to go to Mass on Sunday, I'll have to turn in my 2 weeks' notice. I'm sorry. And who knows, maybe that would get his attention, because if he really likes you, he might say, well, let's see what we can work out. Another possibility, if he wants you there at 7 in the morning and you're getting off at 4, well, there are plenty of parishes that offer an evening Mass on Sunday. Most of them don't, but some do. So perhaps that's another solution if you really want to keep that job. So those are my thoughts. What are your thoughts?
Thank you very much for your input. And thankfully, I have been able to go to Mass at 8 in the morning on Sundays.
Perfect. Well, there you go. So you've got your solution.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Thank you. 888-914-9149. How about Rachel now in North Carolina? Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Patrick.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. I'm calling because my parish currently does not give communion on the tongue, only in the hand since COVID. Mm-hmm. And we're always instructed after the gifts are brought up to wash our hands with hand sanitizer before we approach the communion line.
Yeah.
And this past week when I went, I did as I normally do. And when I was distributed the host from the Eucharistic minister, it promptly jumped out of my palm and went to the floor. And I'm not sure if my hands were sticky or mm-hmm. what happened, but the Eucharistic minister immediately bent down and picked it up from the floor, observed it, kind of looked at it, and then put it back in my hand.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if that was the way I should have handled it, if I should have held the host and not consumed it because it had been on the floor, or what actually should have happened.
So you consumed the host, right?
Oh, I did. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's fine. I mean, some people would balk because germs are on the floor. That's true. But I mean, you're not sick and you're still standing, right? You're still breathing. You're not in the hospital. So your body is pretty tough. Most of us, we're resilient. So yeah, that's what I would have done. First of all, I would not have received the host in my hands in any case, but if that's what happened.
That's really the only option. That's the only option in our church right now.
What a shame. That's a real shame. These exaggerated precautions that are so unnecessary and so contrary to the spirit that should be there at Mass, forcing people not to be able to receive Holy Communion on the tongue. It's a real shame. I'll just leave it at that. It's a real shame if you ask me. But that being what it is, it sounds to me like you did exactly what I would have done. If, you know, the host fell on the ground and then you consume that host, that's what I would have done. Yeah.
Alrighty. They're no longer distributing the blood at the communion.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that's across the board with all Catholic churches right now because of COVID or...
My sense of it, traveling around the country as I have over, say, the last, well, since, you know, the really worst of COVID was over and the churches got open again, I don't know that I've ever seen any distribution of Holy Communion under both kinds since then. And
okay.
I like the symbolism. I think it's beautiful. But the thing is, it's not necessary to receive under both kinds. When you receive even a small particle of the host at Mass, you receive all of Jesus, body, blood, soul, and divinity in his entirety. You're not missing out on anything. And if you receive just a sip of the precious blood from the chalice, you've received all of Jesus, body, blood, soul, and divinity. So at a practical level, one of the problems of the introduction of Mass under both, or communion under both kinds for lay people and for well over 1,000 years in the Latin Rite of the Church, that was never done outside of, say, like a wedding or something for the married couple. But it was just not done. Lay people did not receive under both kinds. And one of the reasons is that there is this kind of creeping tendency, and I've seen it many times in people nowadays, who have a mistaken notion that you have to receive both the precious blood and the host to get, quote unquote, all of Jesus. That's actually a heresy. And you don't. So one of the ways to help reinforce the truth about you receive all of Jesus, body, blood, soul, and divinity, when you receive either the host or the precious blood only, was to have Holy Communion for lay people, just the host. And some people say, well, Patrick, at the Last Supper, Jesus said, take this and eat of it. And he said, take this cup and drink of it. That's true, but he wasn't saying that to lay people. He was saying that to the 12 apostles who were there at the Last Supper and who at the Last Supper were being ordained priests. So that's not a good argument for people to raise that Jesus said, take and eat and take and drink, because he wasn't referring to lay people. But in any case, all of that being the case, it may or may not come back anytime soon. And my guess is, with what seemed to be this weird new era that we're in now with real or imagined deadly diseases, that there's probably not likely that we're going to see it go back to communion under both kinds. I could be wrong, but that's my hunch.
Okay. Well, thank you. That answers my question. I feel a lot better about that.
Great. Well, and the best thing of all is you receive Jesus, body, blood, soul, and divinity into your own body. Isn't that a wonderful thing?
Yeah. Nothing like it.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Rachel. Great talking to you. How about Erica now in California? Good morning, Erica. Welcome.
Yeah. Good morning, Patrick. How are you?
I am loving life, and I'm not too bad for a sinner, all things considered.
Amen. Mm-hmm. So my question was, there seems to be a lot of talk about climate change and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear it everywhere now. And I think, let's see, about a week ago, even Pope Francis, I believe he addressed all the Christians. Excuse me, something in my throat. And he said, I'm trying to find the little quote because I actually wrote it down.
Mm-hmm.
Pope Francis, he was calling humanity to repent and modify ourselves from destructive systems. So he said something like this in regards to the environment, that, you know, we can't continue with these, we can no longer continue with our habits because, you know, the earth can't take it, you know, something to that effect. I was driving, so I mean, I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
But it just seems like, yeah, I work for two doctors and my patients talk about it. And I just want to bring light and truth. I feel like, you know, my purpose in life maybe is just to, I mean, I don't have any children.
Mm-hmm.
And my purpose maybe in life, because I love God so much, is maybe just to, you know, share Christ, what I know, the truth of, you know, everything, I guess.
Okay.
So I just want to educate myself about, you know, the environment. And when somebody makes a claim like there's too many people on this earth, because I've heard that before, people, yeah. I feel that when they talk about children, you know, how many kids are you having? What I hear is that three kids is too many. A lot of young people, because I have nieces and nephews, you know, they're getting to be that age and they don't want kids. They say, oh, I don't want kids. And I just think that there's this massive brainwashing about, you know, population too.
Yeah. Let me just say, Erica, you're talking to somebody who is the father of 11 children. So you probably can guess what my view is on that issue.
Yeah.
Well, why don't we start there? Okay, so in 1970, an author by the name of Paul Ehrlich, he wrote a book called The Population Time Bomb, or The Population Bomb is one of the two. And it was a mass market paperback. It sold millions and millions of copies. And it was basically, it was warmed over Malthusian calculations about that the population would outpace our food production and potable water production and arable land availability, and that eventually in the not too distant future, that the planet would be so overcrowded that it would just become unlivably dire. And this was all the rage for a long time. Now, when I mentioned the Population Bomb book, he was building upon what I think his first name was Thomas Malthus, a British philosopher, had theorized two centuries earlier, in which he said very much the same thing, that the population is expanding exponentially, but food production and these other resources that I just mentioned are not. Therefore, at a certain point, you can graph it out and there will be too many people. The Earth cannot support that. All of that is false. And just about every single prediction that Ehrlich made in the Population Bomb turned out to be absolutely wrong. And what we're seeing now, believe it or not, is there is a real panic in some countries, like China, for example, Russia, certainly, because their population is reaching the tipping point where it's going to begin to implode. So to give an example of that, this disastrous and stupid and evil policy, this one-child policy that the Chinese government enforced upon the population for decades, and women were allowed to have one child, and that's it. If you got pregnant again, they forced you to have an abortion. And so that was their thing. Well, then within the last, I think, 10 years or so, they revised this policy and said, no, you can have two kids. In fact, we want you to have two kids. No more than two kids, but you got to have two kids. Now they're retreating from the two-child policy because they realize the demographers and the actuaries and the people who are number-driven and looking at what this means when you graph it out over time, they're in panic mode because they realize we're not going to have enough people because there have been so many abortions and so much contraception and all of this effort to limit the number of people that there won't be enough people to run this big machine that we now have called society and business and commerce and military and all of the things that we need to keep things going. And so what you're seeing now is some countries, we see this in Scandinavia, for example, where the government is actually paying married couples to have children.
Fact.
You got to have more children, they're saying. Russia, you got to have more children. Please have more children. They're begging people to have more children. And so this belies the ridiculous claims that were being made allegedly in the name of science by people like Paul Ehrlich. He may be a fine guy, maybe a wonderful person. I don't know. And by the way, the book came out in 1968. I said 1970, but it was 68. But what we're living with now is something called global aging. Global aging is the opposite of the so-called population bomb. And that is people, by and large, now COVID changed this. So in the last 3 years, we've noticed a marked decrease in life expectancy around the world, certainly in the United States. It's dropped by like 2 years. It was really close to about 80, like 79.8 or something for men and something a little bit higher for women, but it's dropped, I think, a full 2 years, and it's skewed because of COVID. But in any case, the problem is that there are fewer and fewer people being born, but the older people are by and large living longer, healthier lives. And when you have somebody who's old and retired and not working anymore, not paying into the system, not running this big machine called the economy, but you have fewer and fewer people now who are doing that. Well, what happens is you've got an imbalance in which a growingly disproportionate number of older people are consuming resources that are becoming scarcer and scarcer because there are fewer and fewer younger people who are producing them. So that leads to all kinds of possible terrible things, including, by the way, forced euthanasia. What right now is known as the right to die movement could very easily turn on a dime and become the obligation to die movement, where, listen, you've had a good run. You don't want to be a burden. You're 75, you're 80. Man, you've been here a long time, and we need more resources, and we don't have the money to spend on you. And you've already had a good life, so why don't you not be a burden on your family? We'll give you this pill. You go to sleep. Everything will be great. That's coming. It's actually here now. But it is moving more and more in that direction. So the myth about the population bomb and all that is just that. So there's more I'd like to say, but I have to take a break. Eric, I hope that's helpful. And do I think climate change is real? Sure, I think climate change is real. We've had ice ages and Climate is changing all the time. The real question is, what's causing the climate change? And is it attributable solely or primarily to human beings? That seems to still be a bit of an open debate. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
All right, we are back. By the way, I was thinking about the last caller that we had, and she had asked me about climate change. And I just mentioned in passing that, yeah, climate change certainly is real. I mean, ice ages, ebbing and flowing of weather, and even just microclimate in our day and age. But the question is it caused solely or primarily by human existence? That's the big debate right now. And Cyrus, you know, we had gone to the break and there wasn't a chance to really elaborate on that. But I mean, you yourself have talked, I mean, I've talked with you about this issue before.
It's a fascinating topic. And, you know, of course, the climate changes. It's been changing since the Earth was created. And I think it'd be naive to say we don't have an impact on it. But at the same time, it feels like this is yet another scare tactic by government and big business, and the pharmaceutical companies are in on it.
You mean they want people to be anxious all the time?
All the time.
Huh.
Fear will keep the local systems in line.
And it will. I love that quote. And
it's a powerful tool.
When are we going to wake up that we're constantly being fed a diet of fear?
Mm-hmm.
So, and how many times does Jesus say, be not afraid? We need to stop being afraid.
I agree.
And with climate change, would
use your words.
Thanks. I'm getting so mad. So who's buying all the beachfront property?
That's what I wanted to say.
Right.
Okay. So, I mean, I know that, President Obama was one of the major voices during his tenure as president, so 8 years, and we heard a lot about climate change and Al Gore with his movie and the book and The Inconvenient Truth and all that. But isn't it odd, and I think this is what you're alluding to, isn't it odd that these same people are buying their mansions on the waterfront and Cape Cod and elsewhere, right on the water? They're, you know, I don't begrudge anybody if he wants to buy a mansion, that's great, buy a mansion, enjoy. But why are these same people who are telling us that the oceans are going to rise and flood everything in a matter of years? Of course, the timetable that Al Gore gave us long ago is long since passed. It didn't happen. But why are they buying their mansion waterfront property on the beaches that are supposed to be underwater in a few years? And you asked the question, why would the banks loan them money?
I know the banks have researched this and they wouldn't loan money to property.
I never said you stole money.
That's right. That's good. So what's going on?
It makes you think, doesn't it? That maybe there's something more to it, like control. I don't know. I'm not a climate expert. I don't claim to be. I never have. I leave that to the experts. And some people say, well, that's settled science. Well, I know that there are people who want you to think that it's settled science, but I can't help but wonder about all the scientists who say, well, actually, it's not settled science. There's more to it than that. I don't know. And I have no way of evaluating those scientific things. I have to leave it up to the scientists. But
it seems like it's all a big distraction to keep our eye off the real ball.
Interesting.
So please don't be afraid.
Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Where have I heard that before? Yeah. All right. Well, we got that out of our system. Thank you. How about now, Joy in Los Angeles? I've got Joy down in my heart and on my radio program.
Where?
Welcome, Joy.
Oh, hi, Patrick. Good morning. Thank you for taking
Good
my
morning.
Call.
You're welcome.
I was with you at the Holy Land in 2019.
Oh, wonderful. Wasn't that a beautiful experience?
I know. I don't know when are we going to do that again.
Yes, I am, but I can't talk about it here.
Oh, you
but
are?
If you, yeah, oh, it, it'll, okay. You'll find it. You'll find the info on social media when the time comes. But yeah, the answer is yes. So what is your question for me?
My question was gospel yesterday, and it was the Virgin Mary's birthday, but the gospel was about St. Joseph's genealogy,
right.
And I really haven't heard about the Virgin Mary's genealogy. How is that?
Oh, well.
When in fact, St. Joseph was not really involved with Jesus, correct? Because he is only the foster father.
Right. So let me kind of restate what you just said. Our Lady gave birth to Jesus in a miraculous way, and he was conceived in her womb in a miraculous way. You can read all about that in Luke chapter 1. So it was the overshadowing of the Holy Spirit that brought about the incarnation, excuse me, the conception of Jesus. We call that the incarnation. So Saint Joseph was indeed Our Lady's husband, but the two had a virginal marriage. The two never had marital intimacy. So he, first of all, was not the biological father of Jesus. There was no biological father of Jesus. This was a miraculous event that God himself caused to take place. So there was no father involved in a human sense. And as far as the genealogy is concerned, there is no genealogy per se of Our Lady, but there are two genealogies for Jesus, one in Matthew's gospel, one in Luke's gospel. And what we see here is in Luke's gospel, the genealogy through Our Lady's bloodline. And in the gospel of Matthew, we see the genealogy through the legal pedigree that comes through Joseph. So Joseph was Jesus's legal father, not his biological father, his legal father. And so all the rights and privileges, etc., that pertain to being the legal son or grandson, etc., those are traced through Joseph's genealogy. But the bloodline, because our Lord received his human nature, received his body from Our Lady, that is traced through Luke's gospel. Now, there are some apparent contradictions, but they're only apparent. And the resolution of those things, you'll find that, for example, in the Catholic Encyclopedia online, which you could look up and read it, where it offers you the solution or the harmonization of these apparent contradictions. But there is no genealogy of Mary herself, but that there doesn't really need to be, because her importance is in and through Jesus. So that genealogy will help you.
Yeah, my question was that, why is it important that we know Joseph's genealogy when in fact he did not contribute to, you know?
Well, that's the reason. That's what I was just saying, Joy. It's important because the legal status of Jesus as the son of Joseph under the law, that's why that's important. So the genealogy of Joseph from a bloodline standpoint is not important, because Jesus did not receive. That's why I went into all that detail, is to point out that it's not because of the bloodline that Matthew's genealogy is important, but because of the legal status and the legal connection back to King David.
Is it a sin for me to ask this question? To doubt?
No, it's not a sin, but what are you doubting exactly?
I mean, why do we need to know St. Joseph's genealogy when in fact he did not contribute the bloodline to Jesus? That's what I was, is it, because I have been hearing this and it's only now that I'm asking.
Well, let me put it a different way. Because so I think I've answered that question twice now, but let me try it a different way. Let's say that you were married to a man whose wife died, and he had a son from that first marriage, and you're now married to him. Now, the son is not your biological son. So his genealogy, if you want to call it that, has nothing to do with you. Or actually, I realize I'm kind of modifying it the wrong way. Let me change that. Let's say that you had a son from a prior marriage and your husband died. And now you're married to a man who is not the biological father of your son. He's legally the father of your son, but he's not the biological father of your son. It's important under the law for his status to be established as the legal father, because that gets into questions of things like inheritance And if the two of you die, does your son, even though he's not the biological son, does he stand to inherit the house and things of that nature? That's why it's important. So, no, it's not a sin to have doubts or questions. That's not a sin. God wants us to try to find answers to these questions. But just remember that the Holy Bible is not telling you something unimportant. The Holy Bible is there telling you something that is very important. Anyway, I hope that's helpful. Thank you for that. Let's go to Alicia now in Lodi, California. Hi, Alicia.
Hi, Patrick.
Hi.
I'm calling in because it's in regards to my mom. My dad just recently passed.
I'm sorry.
Which conveniently, I mean, not conveniently, but it's a very warming that I heard your last name, Madrid, because that was his name. Jesus Madrid Real.
May he rest in peace.
And yes, may he rest in peace. And the reason for my call is we have an 8x10 picture of him placed on a table, okay. And she asked that he be removed. I'm not ready yet, but I know her feelings are more important than mine, and I just wanted to hear your input on that.
Sure. I don't think hers are more important than yours. They're just different than yours. You're his daughter, so you have a right to your feelings. Everybody does. So perhaps out of respect for your mother's grief, if you took that picture and put it someplace safe so that when the time is right, you can bring it back out again. If it's painful to her to see the picture of her husband because she's grieving, that's understandable. Not everybody grieves the same way, but I would think that this is going to pass, and in due time, his picture being there won't be painful to her. So just take care of it in the meantime, and then you can look at it, put it in your home. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio, and the number to dial is 888-914-9149. I'll be right back right after this.